inviting us to be here to talk to you today about the Tokyo documents. I just wanted to give a brief background about who we are and what we do, so you can understand. So, I'm a bioinformatician, Steve's a computer scientist. So my world is molecules and atoms and hydrogen bonds and really biology stuff. I think Steve's is even weirder kind of stuff. He sees insides of computers, motherboards and circuits and sockets and all this kind of stuff that I don't understand. So this means that we see the world in very, very different ways. Sometimes we don't even realise how different our perspectives of the world are. We see the world in very different ways. That's a good thing, because it means that we can look at problems and approach them from different perspectives and hopefully come up with other solutions. Okay, so what is utopia? We like to think of utopia as a kind of philosophy realised in software. A new paradigm, if you like, for linking scholarly literature with research data. So why does it matter? It matters because utopia evolved in response to a crisis. I guess for individuals, the volumes of data literature are just becoming unmanageable. So the harbingers of doom seized upon this, sort of peppering scientific papers with portents of impending catastrophe. So I think for many of us, we've either read or written articles that talk about the floods and deluges of data, surging oceans and tsunamis of data, the metaphors get greater and greater, avalanches, earthquakes, and even explosions of data. So the real problem, it isn't the actual data generation, we can do lots and lots and lots of that. The real issue is the systematic burial of the knowledge embedded in those data. It's trying to, now I was going to go leap over here and point to the slide, but I won't do that. The real issue is, it's the stuff that's in all these tubes. Knowing what's in there, trying to get stuff out, and relating the bits and pieces that are in all of those separate silos or tubes to each other. So there's just so much stuff out there today that we no longer know what we know, and finding what we have, what we want, is difficult. It's harder than it should be. So I think many of us will relate to this situation where what we're faced with day in, day out is a mountain of information. The real challenge is to hack away at it and to find those nuggets, those golden nuggets of knowledge. That's the hard part. So the truth is that if your work depends on extracting knowledge from text, mine does, one of my many guises, I'm a database curator. So if you really have to spend all your day trying to find the interesting stuff, those little nuggets of knowledge within text, so this is really difficult to do, and sometimes you just want to give up. So I think a perfect example of that kind of situation is a quote, given by a quote from Amos Bayrock last year. So Amos is one of the most famous European bioinformaticians, responsible for creating many of the databases that we use today in bioinformatics. And he said, it's quite depressing to think that we're spending millions in grants for people to perform experiments, produce new knowledge, hide this knowledge in often badly written text, and then spend some more millions trying to second guess what the authors really did and found. So this really sums up perfectly, certainly what my life is about, and I'm sure for many of us this will ring very true. So the good news is that several initiatives have been devised to address some of these issues, to try to rescue the knowledge being locked in our literature and data tubes. So obviously I don't have time to talk about any of these in detail, but I think it's fitting and appropriate to mention some of those. A couple of them you've heard about already, Project Prospect, of course, and Ken Spider from the Royal Society of Chemistry. There was Phelps Letters Experiment with Structured Digital Abstracts, Phil Bourne's work with BioLit, David Shotton's work with PLOS-NTD, and of course, Elsevier's Grand Challenge winner, Reflect. Okay, so why is utopia different, and how does it help? At this point, I'll pass over to my lovely sister to give you the technical reasons why.
Okay. That's a great, very much. Forehand. many of the tools out there at the moment for enriching content work with HTML. But in spite of all the added richness that you can add to HTML and online content, the reality is still that most scientists and most publishers will admit this, 80% or more, download the content and read PDFs. But PDFs had quite a bad press in recent years. There's been some sort of growing anti-PDF movement. And here are some words, some quotes that came from the Science Online conference last week. So exactly who these are getting into is slightly complicated, so I've left out the names of the people who said them. The PDF is an insult to science. They're often very strongly held views. It's like inventing the phone and using it to transmit Morse code. And my favourite, PDF is a hamburger and we're trying to turn it back into a cow. And I mean, I can see where all these comments are coming from. The PDF is, in many senses, a form of electronic paper. It encapsulates static stuff written in a linear format with pictures and words. But from my point of view, the case for the defence of the PDF, it's just a way of displaying text and images. In many senses, it's no different to HTML and the other technologies that are used to make web pages. It's a format in which you can put words and pictures in a way that a computer and a human can see the content of those words and pictures. So blaming the PDF is a little bit like blaming paper and ink for being a bad way of writing stuff down. It's just the medium. The hamburger is not so much the PDF or even HTML, it's the act of scholarly writing. The fact that you need that in some cases to take your ideas and turn them into a linear narrative, that's the problem, is that humans like linear narrative and computers don't like linear narrative. It's very likely, I think, that the linear narrative, certainly in scientific articles, is here to stay for quite a long time at least. There's a good discipline involved in being able to turn your ideas into something that you can write into an article and transmit to other people. And people will read those articles in different ways. Perhaps the first encounter with it, they will want to read it as a linear story, and perhaps later they'll be wanting to dip in and out of it and link backwards and forwards and flip around in different parts of the context. But at some point, somebody will want to read it in a linear way, and that's perfectly okay. So we shouldn't pretend that that's going to go away too soon. People are almost certainly isn't. But relating the content of that narrative to the data that narrative talks about is becoming increasingly important. So making that story link back to the vast amounts of experimental data, usually that have been compressed into a scientific article, is becoming much more important. And so what we need to do, really, rather than wrangle too much about the technology that we're using to display these things, is to encourage authors and editors to be rigorous in providing the relationship between scientific articles and the underlying data that was used to generate those articles. And this boils down to a problem of mindset, really, rather than a problem of technology. It's a cultural and mindset thing. But at the moment, we're happy to talk about a particular protein by its informal name, rather than saying this protein is the one in that database that's putting that record on that day. You can't even mechanism for doing that. So it's not really this, I don't think this should become a battle between display formats and a battle between HTML and PDF. So although I'm saying that PDF and HTML in some ways are very similar, there are a couple of caveats that I'd like to add. It's not true that PDF format is as amenable to the kind of markup and interaction that we'd like to do as HTML. HTML is a slightly easier format to deal with. But PDF isn't impossible. There are nowhere near as many tools for interacting with PDF, apart from just displaying it as a handy document that you can carry around with you. There aren't that many tools for doing it compared to the number of tools for manipulating and generating HTML content. And this means that interacting with PDFs and treating them as anything other than static documents, it's not quite as easy as doing it with HTML. But it's not impossible. So what I'd like to do now is give you a demonstration of Utopia Documents, which is some software that we've developed in conjunction with Portland Press, to try and bring some of the interactivity and semantic content that you can put into web pages to the humble PDF. So. So it's slightly like doing it live tonight. No title, what's going to happen. Right, so I'll start with Utopia Documents. Utopia Documents is a PDF reader, and it has the same kind of functionality as you'd expect of a normal PDF reader. So the first thing I'm going to do here is open a paper I've recently told you from there. And here is the first page of the paper. It's an article that we published in the Biochemical Journal about Utopia Documents last year. And it includes sort of the standard things you would expect with PDF readers, so I can sort of thumbnail through the various different pages. Now, the first thing to notice is that on the right-hand side here, the first thing that Utopia Documents has done is it has tried to recognise the content of this paper. So it's read this paper much as a human would read this paper. It uses computer graphics techniques to analyse the form and structure of the paper in order to find interesting features within the paper. This will become clearer as I go through the demonstration. But the first thing we've got here is the sort of the bibliometric metadata about this paper. Its title, who the authors are, keywords, its mentions of the abbreviations, access to the bibliography. So the bibliography has been extracted from this paper and is available in another clickable form here. If I can click on that, it goes through, in this case, to Google Documents, because I'm not connected to any particular institutional repository. And that gives you relatively straightforward ways of moving from the content of the bibliography to other papers. So, going back to the paper itself, down at the bottom here on the thumbnails, what you can see are these little red sort of dog ears which have appeared on some of the pages. So this first page has got one, these haven't got one. This page here, for example, has got a dog ear on it. So if I go to this page here, these little red marks say Utopia has done something extra to this page. It's adding some additional content which relates to an object on that page. And these marks here in the margin show you whereabouts on that page it's found some interesting stuff. So this red mark is not in the original PDF. This is something that Utopia Documents has added to that PDF dynamically in between me loading this PDF and showing it up on screen here. So if I point at this object, it says, yes, that's an object that Utopia has done something with. I press the play button. This, which is a static image of the table, becomes an interactive version of that table where I can go in and if I wanted to, I could change the numbers and get it behaves very much like a spreadsheet and can scroll around and modify the content of that. Or perhaps more usefully, I can go to this little icon over here on the right and the table becomes a graph of data. If I point to any of the data points, it knows what those data points are. If I click on that again. I'll put that away. Or I can regraph that, come to a different axis, draw the graph again, as I did before, get a different graph. Go on to another page. So here we have, this paper that we're looking at here is a slightly weird paper because it's a paper about papers, so it has lots of pictures of papers inside the papers. So if I go to this diagram here, which is a picture of a molecule, again, press the play button. And now that information for that three-dimensional molecule was downloaded live from the protein data bank, as I did it then. So it gives you access to the underlying data for objects or multiple sequence alignments, which are these are things that only Terry really understands. But there are these are protein sequences which you can interact with. And if I was a biologist, I'd be able to do clever things. So I'll go back to the first page of this. So these objects have been marked up so far by the editors of this particular journal, and so they've gone and said, yes, that table has this content, this object here is that molecule. But something that Richard was talking about is the balance between the cost of curating or doing manuals for product quality assurance and getting all slightly scrappy data. The other thing that you can do with taking documents is the users or readers can look up terms themselves. So if I go down here and see the word G-protein chemical receptor, which hasn't been marked up by an editor, and select it, press the store button. So this is now looking that term up in the databases to which it's currently linked. So we get definitions of that term, and these are live from Wikipedia or from ChemSpider or from BioCycle or from wherever it is that term returns a hit. These haven't been curated by the journal's editors, so whether you believe this content or not is up to you. It's very much up to the readers to whether they like that kind of whether they trust Wikipedia or whatever particular source it is for that data. The other thing we can do here is up here we see there's a little speech bubble has appeared, and this is a comment that's been added to this paper after its publication. So this is a comment that a reader has looked at this paper and added a comment to it, which then gets shared with every other reader of this paper, regardless of when they downloaded this particular thing. So it's fetched on the fly. So if I click on that, it brings up, so this is actually a comment from Adam, and I like that to start a discussion, which means that you can start a discussion in the paper after it has been published. Yes. And then the other thing that you can do is you can use this to as a mechanism of searching for content that's something generic of content that's related to this paper. So it'll go to the places and allow you to look at terms. So it's a way of reducing the barrier to accessing databases. Semantic linked data type clouds, and bringing the kind of interactive content that we normally associate with HTML and online content to back to the Humble PDF. That's it. So if there's any questions, take them.
Sue coming from Innes. Looks really exciting to me because we work with very plain PDFs and people we work with just don't have the facilities to be using HTML or anything like that. So what I'm not really clear about is who uses this? Is this the publisher using it and then when you load it onto the website it has all these features, or does the user have to have it?
Both. So some more things about proteins. So you have to use Utopia Documents as the PDF reader. But you can also use it as an editor or as an author to put extra content in. I find more things. So it's used by both. So if I was an author, I can use the panel on the left here to mark up content. So I find words associated with concepts. But if I don't do that, then most of the time it still works, and you can mark up concepts yourself as a reader and see the content dynamically now.
So basically, you'd have to have all the people out there having this.
Yes, you have. The downside of it is that you have to use this as your PDF viewer.
And so, how can people do that?
You should download it and install it. It runs on Windows and Mac. So,
for free?
Yes, for free.
Wow. We need to talk.
So,
Steve probably didn't say is at the moment the software, because it was developed with Portland Press have the editorial side of the tools in-house and they do the markup. We haven't yet released.
No, that's true.
So we haven't yet released a version that will allow authors to do this too. And I think that's going to be actually something that's key is allowing authors to do this as well, because the burden at the moment is on in-house editorial teams. Not every publishing house has those. And obviously we want to engage all authors and readers in this process of adding value, really, so spreading the cost.
Adrian Stanley from the Charles. I guess the first question is, you mentioned a lot about PDF and HTML, but there are technologies like XML that come into the PDF, and some publishers are putting more data already in the PDF with technology like PDF XMP.
Yeah.
That's going to help and support this process.
It is, yeah. I mean, the more information that's there in the underlying XML, the better the resulting product, whether it's an HTML or PDF, is going to be. So having the more metadata, basically, the better.
And then I guess the second question we come to is the plans to work with other publishers. This is still a trial with Portman, I guess. What's the rollout plan for you?
The rollout plan is that we would like now to work with other publishers. I mean, this is something.
We're promiscuous, I think.
I was trying to say that more delicately. Portman has been very clear that they don't want to be the sole people using this, and they've been very clear about the fact that if they become the only people using this, where do people use it? You know, just fade out. So it's something that we'd be very keen on to work with other publishers on.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks. Tony Rook, IOP. I was just wondering, I saw this demo at SSP, I think, back in June, and Adam kindly showed how it works, and actually showed he's working with an IOP paper as well, which kind of blew me away. What does a publisher need to do to make this work? Well, what do we need to do to change it, to amend our workflows, our DTDs, to make this happen on our own platforms?
The answer to that is slightly complicated. So some of it will work with you doing nothing, it will just work on
awesome.
So you'll be seeing some of the... So I can take a paper and apply... so some of the text mining type stuff will happen, whatever. So I'll reflect on this. This is running the Reflect tool, the thing that won the R3 Grand Challenge, but instead of applying it to web pages, this is now applying it to this particular PDF. So you can see terms starting to appear at the expanded within there. So this kind of stuff will work on any paper. The mechanism for curating terms so that you know that they've been added in there by a particular editor. It's relatively straightforward. After you have the PDF, before it gets published, the editors need to spend somewhere between 10 minutes and half an hour. I don't know. 5 to 10 minutes now. Okay, so when we first started using this, it was bits per paper, but it sounds as though the process is now becoming a small number of bits per paper.
Sorry, can I just have a thing in there? Audrey said to me that it's entirely dependent on how much you want to mark up the paper as well, so you can spend as little time on it, or as much time on it as you really want to, and then when the authoring tools come into play, obviously, whether you need to spend a significant amount of time may reduce the quality. But
I think that response speaks to your earlier question about how do you know, is it, you know, high-impact paper, is it, do we bother to expend the energy on those that we think are not going to make it? So.
And you can always look at the terms that haven't been marked up on the fly anyway.
Jeffrey Builder, Crosstrack. So it looks brilliant. The problem is that I want it on MIPS.
Mm-hmm.
Any plan?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Wolf Hire, librarian, University of Leicester. It looks to me like this could be a very well, very, very useful service for readers. So is this something I as a librarian could introduce in my library and try to introduce to my users and to educate them and to help them?
And it's something we'd be very keen to see happen.
Well, are there already any experiences that you know from libraries doing so?
Not yet.
We're trying to educate the University of Manchester.
Okay, but it sounds as if it was not very successful.
No. Can I just ask that? I'm presenting on this at the
Charles. Just wait. I know everybody can hear you, but I'm just.
Adam Martin, Warren Press. I'm presenting on this at the Charleston Conference in November, which is 30% libraries. So hopefully we'll have some feedback about what libraries see, how the libraries see it being used for their readers. But the other side is that we see it as a tool for Warren Press and for the Biochemical Journal for the editorial board to use, because they can use it as part of their reviewing process to go off and start checking information, data sets and things like that as they're reviewing the paper in a way that they can only do using more complex methods at the moment.
I guess a lot, Adrian again, from Charles was I guess a lot of these comments will need moderating and checking, so is this another, you know, additional...
So the plan at the moment is not to moderate comments, because, well, I mean, it becomes a... From a legal point of view, if you say you don't moderate these comments, then you don't have to moderate those comments. If you say you do moderate those comments, then the onus would be on us as a small research team to moderate any comments that get generated. So our plan at the moment is essentially not to moderate comments, and hope that in the way of social networking that they sort of take care of themselves on the whole. So we only have to have a takedown policy for anything that's libelous or offensive. So there's a mechanism where you can report offensive or inappropriate comments, but we're hoping that apart from that, and we don't really want it to be something where the editors are restricting what comments can be made about papers. The whole point is for it to be an open platform where people can discuss papers within those papers in a free and open kind of way.
I have a question sort of related to that. What has your feedback been from authors in terms of having their papers commented on and also having to possibly add this extra step up?
Can we pass over to...
Adam Marshall, Portland Press. I think it's too early to tell. I mean, the thing is, wherever we put in tools for authors to comment on things, whether it's in this form or in other versions of networking, authors are very reticent about saying anything, we find. I mean, maybe chemistry is different, but biochemists in the bar, they'll say a lot, but putting their name on paper doesn't really happen very much. So I think it would be a slow thing, and also it links into the sort of social networking talk yesterday. It's educating the people who have had long held practices to start doing different things. So again, we're waiting to see.
I'd say it's part of a cultural change as well. I mean, once people see the power of these things, then what you can actually use them for, and maybe start to pick up momentum or gather. So it's too late.
Okay, I think we should probably wrap up. So
can I just say one last thing, which is we didn't show our acknowledgement slide. We didn't get grants, so I have to thank Portland Press for their investment in this project. So thank you.